Good evening, everybody. On behalf of Indira Gandhi National Center for the Arts, I welcome you all to today's lecture, Emporiums of Indian Ocean Trade, Witnessed by the Java Sea Shipwrecks of the 9th and 10th Centuries by Dr. John Gray. Dr. John Gray is a curator of South and Southeast Asian art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, New York, with research interests in the areas of Hindu, Buddhist, Jain sculpture, early temple arts and sculptural traditions of South and Southeast Asia, and in the ceramic and textile trade of Indian Ocean diaspora. He joined the Metropolitan Museum's Asian Department in 2008 after 22 years at the Victoria and Albert Museum, London, where he served as senior curator of Asia. He has served on the councils of the European Associations of South Asia and Southeast Asian Archaeology and has been awarded a number of research grants, including those from the British Academy, the Nehru Trust, and the Getty Curatorial Research Scheme. He has acted as an advisor to UNESCO on historical sites in Southeast Asia and worked in partnership with government archaeological agencies in Thailand, Laos, and Vietnam. This has included a number of archaeological excavations and the documentation of both land and maritime sites of World Heritage importance in the region. His major publications include Oriental Trade Ceramics in Southeast Asia, Ceramic Traditions of Southeast Asia, Arts of India 1550 to 1900, Indian Art and Connoisseurship, Vietnamese Ceramics, a Separate Tradition, Woven Cargoes, Indian Textiles in the East, Indian Temple Sculpture, Chola Bronzes of Southern India, Lost Kingdoms, Hindu-Buddhist Culture of Early Southeast Asia. He has curated and co-curated many exhibitions, most recently Gods of Angkor, Khmer Bronzes from the National Museum of Cambodia, Wonder of the Age, Master Painters of India, Cambodian Ratan, the sculpture of C.P. Pick, Interwoven Globe, the Worldwide Textile Trade 1500 to 1800, and Lost Kingdoms, Hindu-Buddhist Culture of East, Early Southeast Asia, 5th to 8th Century. I invite Dr. John Guy to please deliver his lecture. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'm delighted to see such a large audience here today. It's a great pleasure to be here and an honor to be speaking as part of this maritime project. What I thought I would do this evening is present three cargoes which were recovered in the last 15 years, the first in 1998, the others in the early 2000s, and which represent a very major contribution, in many ways a transforming, had a transforming impact on our understanding of long distance trade in the Indian Ocean world. This is the discovery of shipwreck cargoes in general, time capsules as they are, allow us to get a window into a particular time frame, space and time, to understand the dynamics of what was happening, the nature of trade and exchange over vast distances. The oceans, of course, were the historic highways. They were the means of connecting tracts of land separated by thousands of inhospitable land, but traveling by sea, one could make those journeys. Risky as they were, it was a high risk venture to undertake what historically was the longest maritime trade route in the world, being undertaken in the mid-first millennium between the Persian Gulf region, the port, particularly of Basra, serving Baghdad, to South China, to Guangdong, to Ningbo, to Yangzhou, the great ports of Tang China, which in turn were connected to Korea and Japan. So this was a massive undertaking. Dangerous, risky. The Arabic commentators, when they start appearing in the 8th and 9th century, speak of the loss of vessels being such a frequent occurrence, and high risk, high gain enterprises. What I want to present tonight is one spectacular cargo and two others which are of a different nature but also very important, which help us understand the nature of long distance trade and exchange. Which, of course, is commercially motivated. It's also, in some senses, on some occasions politically motivated in terms of diplomatic gift exchange taking place between courts and rulers. And it also serves as a way of carrying cultural messages. The artifacts themselves have their own independent lives, and they in turn can impact on the cultures that receive them and absorb them and produce their own art in response to these exotic objects coming into their midst. So trade and exchange is a multifaceted process, and the outcome is often unpredictable. It's not simply the buying and selling of commodities on a mundane level, though it's certainly that as well. But there are many other more profound aspects to it, as we'll see in the presentation tonight. The route that I described to you really is one which extends from Basra, the great port of Siraf, which is not named here, but down to the point in Muscat, then down the west coast of India, across the Arabian Sea. The Red Sea trade, of course, was also very important and linked, of course, through to the eastern Mediterranean and opened up all of that. And, of course, the Mediterranean-Red Sea trade to the Malabar coast of India has been enormously important since antiquity. The trade conducted, we know, in Roman times and commented on from the Roman period onwards, the importance of black pepper, native product of the Malabar coast, in demand in the Mediterranean world, both as a condiment for food, but more significantly as a preservative for food, very, very important. And, of course, the demand for the finest cottons in the world. No one produced better cottons than India. That was true 2,000 years ago. It's more or less true today. The muslins of Bengal and elsewhere were in great demand in the late Roman world, and to the extent that people complained how expensive they were. And rather sort of significant imbalances of trade seemed to occur because India insisted on being taking any currency as long as it was a hard metal, preferably gold or silver, but copper would do if necessary. So in exchange for commodities which are essentially renewable, cotton fabrics, spices which could be grown and replenished every year and so on. So a constant process. The net result of that, of course, is the subcontinent became enormously a great treasure house of precious metals historically through time. It still remains, I think it's fair to say there's more gold in private hands in the subcontinent than anywhere else on planet Earth. So this is a product of a long process of absorbing and seeking supplies of gold from afar. And this will come into the story as well as we proceed. So the Arabian Sea, west coast of the subcontinent, critically important. And then the trade routes that take one to the equatorial regions of western Indonesia, the Straits of Malacca, Sumatra, Malay Peninsula. This is the world where if you're making a long-distance journey, you're obliged to break your journey because of the nature of the monsoon winds. They have to seasonally change direction. And so there's an obligatory wait over. They can take some R&R in Malaysia if they wish until the winds change and they embark on the next part of their journey. It had traditionally been thought that these journeys were far too ambitious and they for any single vessel to undertake, and it was very likely that we were looking at a chain of supply, a series of interconnected trade systems with entrepôts at different points where goods changed hands. And to some extent, that remains a valid theory. But the staggering discovery of the early 9th century shipwreck that I'll present in a few minutes in the West Java Sea makes very clear that the vessel which sank with its massive cargo of Chinese both luxury and everyday consumption goods and had clearly sailed from one of the major ports of South China, Yangzhou, and probably Yangzhou originally and then Canton, Guangdong, was destined to go all the way to the Persian Gulf. And that is a massive journey at any time in the late 8th, early 9th century. It's a pretty challenging bit of sailing. Now, we had lots of indicators, if we can only track them down, to give us a clue as to the nature of the interaction between South Asia and Southeast Asia in early times. And all of you know Savana Bhumi, Savana Dwipa, the lands, the islands of gold. These are the names which show up in early Indian sources, particularly Buddhist and Jain commentaries, which speak of merchants who venture, young sons of family who venture out to make their fortunes or not, east. And again, this appetite for gold, which drove so much of the early overseas activity of Indian merchants, was directed towards island Southeast Asia, which is rich, particularly in alluvial gold, coming from Sumatra, Borneo, not Java. Java's gold poor, but so these other, and Malay Peninsula, these are regions that are rich in alluvial natural sources of gold. And we know that Indians were going early to source this material, and on the back of that, there was the cultural baggage. There were concepts of kingship, concepts of state formation, and of course, belief systems. Brahmanical belief systems, Buddhism, found their way into the region early, essentially on the back of this mercantile activity, I would suggest. And they show up early. So here we have a little working stone. It's a tool of a goldsmith. It's small. It's only 6 by 3 inches or 2.5 inches, engraved with a very rough Brahmi script inscription, which gives the name of the identifies the owner of the item, and it says that it's the property of the great goldsmith Perumal. He's southern, he's probably Tamil, and he was working somewhere in the Malay Peninsula around the 3rd century AD, if we trust the epigraphy. So this is a window immediately on the nature of the gold working activities taking place in Southeast Asia. They're not only sourcing gold in Southeast Asia in the early centuries AD, they were processing it, they were adding value to it. And here is one of his tools. Goldsmiths are very mobile. You can pack all the tools you need for most gold working in a kit bag and take it with you. And I show you a 1900s photograph from North Sumatra. This is Aceh, Indonesian goldsmith workers here, Malays. And this gentleman in the middle who looks distinctly un-Malay, and I'd suggest that he's almost certainly of South Asian descent, appears to be the man in charge of this gold working activity. The site of Takuapa on the Malay Peninsula, on the Isthmus of Kra, the narrowest point in the Malay Peninsula, well known in Indian sources, and it's a site which we also know was a very important gold working centre. Traces of worked gold have been recovered at this site, and it was clearly very well established and continued for many, many centuries. We don't know the nature of the resident South Asian community there, but clearly a significant one. They maintained a significant Vaishnavite shrine, of which major sculptures survived. Nothing of the structure has come down to us. What's often the case, built structures disappear because you've got very convenient cut stone and fired bricks. They're recycled. They disappear into the fabric of other structures, but the sculptures remain. Benign neglect is one of the best forms of conservation, as many of you will know. here they've been conserved by the trees, actually, very, very benignly. They've since been liberated from the trees and put in a small museum in Surat Thani, but here you see them in their original position still in the 1940s. I just should mention that this site also boasts a very important inscription, undated, but good evidence to date it to the 9th century. It mentions the establishment of a tank, and it also makes reference, where there's a tank, the presumption is it's a tank associated with the temple. Temple is no more, the tank is no more actually, but the inscription tells us that a tank was dedicated and funded and maintained by one of the merchant guilds from the Deccan. And their name, the merchant guild is named, and this was their place of worship. The resident population, probably very small. Seasonal population, probably quite large. They would come every year to do their trading and go back. and a core population would remain. That's often the pattern. West coast of Sumatra, not a very hospitable part of the world, facing straight onto the Indian Ocean. A site called Burras, very famous for the production of resins and alluvial gold. 11th century inscriptions actually dated equivalent to 1088, and again makes a very interesting commentary on the, obliging all the merchants who are active in this community, and they're belonging to two named merchant guilds, well known from Dakani inscriptions, expressly states that they're obliged to contribute in gold to a pension fund, essentially, to support their community and support anyone, any families in need within their community. And there's a prohibition that if you don't contribute, you will not be permitted to step on the cloth, is the phrase that's used, step on the cloth to engage in trade. And it ends with a very nice line about great merit accrues from charity. So very nice message. And I couldn't resist putting in this 17th century early Nayaka mural painting from the Kaveri River district in Tanjavur district, which shows merchants doing precisely that. The gem traders, you can see the rather handsome collection of stones, and sitting on the cloth doing their transactions, a very important series of paintings in a Shaiva temple near Tiruvenkalu, in a sort of post-Vijayanagara style of early Nayaka period. You recognize the very distinctive headgear, which is essentially inherited from Vijayanagara traditions. We know them from Lapakshi and other places. Now, moving the story forward, the spread of South Asian culture through trade, and particularly through the agency of the Tamil merchants, extends all the way up to South China. And we see very interesting evidence for this. There's a lot of historical sources that talk about the activities of Indians. Not really, Malays are active. Indians unspecified. They don't distinguish Kalinga from Tamil, from Gujarati, or whatever. That's in the early periods. Later they do. By the 12th, 13th century, they think of India as about five. They treat it like about five different countries. There's five different cultural zones. So Gujarat, Malwa, Malabar, Coromandel, and so on, distinct regions. China understood them as separate countries. In one sense, I guess they were. We know that there were foreign merchants, whom Indians were a significant part, in Canton in the 7th and 8th century, maintained a whole series of temples. There was a large Islamic community, West Asian Muslims. There may have all been some South Asian Muslims already, though that's a little bit on the early side for them, but certainly coming from West Asia. The most famous mosque that still stands, I'll show you a photo in a moment, in Canton, was certainly founded at least by the 7th century. These foreign communities were very, very important and really drove the economy of these southern coastal cities. They were really international trade cities. This is Chuanzhou. Some of you will know it from Marco Polo's work. It's the city of Zeton in Arabic. In Marco Polo's commentaries, Chuanzhou in Fujian came to prominence really in the post-Tang period, in the 10th, 11th century, and the northern and southern Song period of Chinese history, and had very important Indian communities who appear to have been Tamil, and we have inscriptions to support that. This Kaiyuan Temple, it's a 16th century renovation. The temple's much older, but we know it was fully renovated in the 16th century. And when they did the renovation, they appear to have recycled significant amounts of a now abandoned, presumably abandoned, Hindu temple in Fujian, in Chuanzhou city. And so what they used were the pillars, Chola-style pillars, integrated into the veranda of this Chinese temple. This was almost certainly late 12th or early 13th century as the Hindu temple, we assume survived up until probably in a ruinous state, probably abandoned by this point, whereupon these building stones, the finest pieces, went into the premier temple of the city, Kaiyuan Temple. And where did all the rest of it go? Hundreds of building blocks of stone, many of them finely carved on one face. They went into an extension of the city wall, which was built in the Ming period. When that city wall was torn down in 1956 during the Cultural Revolution to modernize the city, they discovered some hundreds of building stones from a Hindu temple. And they're quite spectacular. Here are some of the medallions from the pillars, Garuda Asana, Gajendra Moksha, very familiar themes to you all. And in the 1960s, this inscription was found. Many of the stones were that didn't come out of the demolition of the city wall were recovered from people's homes, pigsties, wherever, whatever places they'd recycled the building stones just as materials. This was a single inscription that got broken at some point in modern times. It's dated to the early 13th century and makes very clear that this is a gift of Sambandha Paramal, is the name given of the person who supported this new temple for Hara, for Shiva. Sambandha Paramal, Paramal's southern, yes, Tamil, Sambandha. That sounds very like the Persian Sambandha for harbour master, the person in charge of controlling maritime affairs. And that position we know was existed in the Persian Arabic world and was borrowed into the wider maritime world. So the post of Sambandha existed in South China, and usually the leaders of those communities held that post, because the top businessmen basically controlled the commercial activities of the harbour for their own community. And the communities were large to the extent they were permitted in many instances to operate under their law rather than local law. So if an Arab merchant misbehaved, committed a crime, he would be tried by his own community under Islamic law, not under Chinese law, ditto other nationalities. Very, very interesting. So we have the name of the person and we have the date to the early 13th century, like 1211, I think. And we also have a statement that this temple was constructed with the consent, the express consent. Obviously, they'd applied for a permit, a building permit, in other words, to the Mongol administration. And it refers to a name which approximates Kublai Khan. And mentions a firman. A firman is a sort of letter of authority. So they're following Mongol administration requirements to build this foreign temple in Yuan Dynasty China. All of that's contained in the inscription. And then there's a little gloss at the bottom in Chinese. Now, some of the remains have been lost. These were photographs from the late 1950s and 60s. A number of pieces disappeared then in the Cultural Revolution. This is one, a rather sort of clumsy version of Shiva Nataraj in a rather quaint temple setting. And what you get a very quick sense of looking at this is that these weren't produced by Indian craftsmen. I mean, this is clearly Chinese work being produced, iconographically directed by a Brahmin priest, no doubt, but not executed by an Indian craftsman, but rather by Chinese working under the direction. You see that when they treat lotus flower, for example, dragons, very comfortable. They know exactly how to do a dragon or a lotus in the Chinese manner. They're less comfortable doing a picture of someone dancing with his leg raised in the air. That was a challenge for them. Kali, this original photograph from the 60s, here she is today. She didn't make it to the temple. She's been appropriated, and now she's under worship as Kaiyuan, which is Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, and it's a maritime town, so really it's in her role as protector of mariners, which is an important aspect. Just culturally appropriated. And that's in a little street shrine in the suburbs of the city, a lane. I mean, you can't take a car, you've got to walk down a series of lanes to find this little shrine where she is today, painted in light, bright enamel paints. Very familiar scene. Do you know South Indian art? The story of 7th century, a story associated with one of the Shaiva poet saints of South India. And I won't take time with the story, but the cow lustrating the linga is an act of veneration. This and a number of series of other reliefs, like the famous legend of the elephant and the spider competing to worship the linga. Again, it's a very specific story, both stories created in Tanjavur district in the late first millennium. This one is particularly associated with temples near Trichy. And I looked at these in the past with a view to trying to speculate, really, no more than speculation, but to try and attempt to see if we could create some understanding of where these merchants may have originated. Where were their their home places, where they, why were these subjects chosen? They're not sort of standard generic subjects, they're rather specific to places in pilgrim sites in South India. So that was an attempt to suggest that these merchants might have come from the Kaveri River Delta area, which does make sense because when you're in the Yuan period, of course, was in regular contact with the Cholas. They had consistent diplomatic exchange, particularly in the early 13th century, quite regular. And all the major ships sailed from Nagapattinam, which is at the delta of the Kaveri. So it all fits together as a plausible story. Here is the great mosque in Canton. It's been there really since probably the late 7th century. It was certainly very well recognized in the 8th century. This minaret has been continually maintained since that time. Chonjo boasts a whole series of mosques, had a long history of Islamic community there. We have an extensive series, particularly of tombstones from Chonjo, which record the origins of many of the merchants. And of course, the merchant gives his name when he passed away, and that he was a son of Kashan or Isfahan or, Samarkand or wherever it was, the name is given in the tombstone. So we have a very clear picture. And a Chinese scholar has worked specifically on the corpus of Islamic tombstones from Chonjo and the Song and Yuan periods. And we built up a very comprehensive picture of the origin of these merchants from West Asia operating in South China. Now, we're going to be coming shortly to the very important role of West Asian trading vessels. But before we do, I wanted to show you the first major shipwreck discovery that started to change our understanding about the long-distance trade in the South China, Indian Ocean world. This was the vessel discovered in the late 1970s, in the harbour of Chonzhou port. They've just walled this up for temporary excavation. The waters are very shallow in this area. It was just in the bay, and it got swamped. It was clearly on its return journey, had almost no Chinese products on board, but it had traces of aromatic woods and traces of spices. It was all clearly coming back from Southeast Asia with these natural products for which the region was so famous, to sell at great profit in Chonzhou, got swamped in the harbour, almost home after all those months of effort, and the cargo was lost. A substantial vessel, very substantial, series of bulkheads, and the timbers of the vessel almost entirely intact, 90% intact. It's been taken out and they've built a site museum for it. It's one of the best preserved vessels, Southern Song, so it's probably 11th century, really opened up our understanding. What's interesting about this, that this vessel represents the beginning of Chinese engagement in long-distance trade. Before that, they didn't bother, or they didn't know. They weren't very interested in going out to sea. They let others come to them. China was always receiving. The Malays built up a great navigational capacity because they live in on islands. You think of the great ships depicted on the reliefs in Borobudur, first decade of the 9th century. These ocean-going ships with outriggers, like the prows that still operate in the Indonesian waters, smaller scale today than they were in the 9th century. The Malays came in great numbers. We know that South Asians came in great numbers, and West Asians. So the Chinese really were not very enterprising until the Song Dynasty, and they started to engage in active trade themselves, and they also started to build navies. This is the harbour. This is where the ships from Basra would have pulled in, literally, in Chuanzhou, and the shipwreck is just a little out to sea, as you see it today. The ships which dominated the Indian Ocean trade throughout its entire history, and which were technologically the smartest ships afloat, so to speak, was the Arab dhow. The Arab dhow is the most resilient boat in antiquity, precisely because it's a stitched construction. It's not rigid. It's not pegged or nailed. It's the plank upon plank, put edge to edge, and then bound with cord, with usually coconut fiber cords, corked, and they flex. They can cope, as you know, with modern-day architecture. If you want a building not to fall down an earthquake, you allow it to move. You give it some capacity to move. If you keep it rigid, it'll snap. These boats rarely snapped, but their downside was they did leak rather a lot, so I think you had to keep bailing. But they were great vessels for long-distance trade. This is a very important 13th-century manuscript from Warif in the Persian Gulf, a very famous manuscript illustration now in the National Library in Paris. And it's got all the right features. We're told from the text that it's a vessel of Indian merchants, whether they're Indians trading across the Arabian Sea or whether they're West Asian traders going to India, we're not totally sure. They're certainly Muslims, or they seem to be turbaned, but they're involved in the India trade, shall we say, which was so important. Notice the anchor. We know that type of anchor, wooden downshaft, two crossbars cut of stone and threaded together. Classic dhow type anchor construction, and all the other features, again, are nautically, quite accurate. So this is the sort of vessel that traditionally dominated the trade. And up until 1999, we'd never seen one outside the Arabian Peninsula until in 1998-99, when the shipwreck I'll be coming to in just a moment was discovered. Less than a year ago, spring last year, 2014, a second Arab dhow was discovered in the Thai Peninsula. They were preparing this land for a prawn farm, coastal land, and the workers discovered this very substantial vessel. Again, it's a stitched construction. It's almost certainly an Arab dhow involved in the West Asian trade. It's not yet been reported or published. This photograph is from the Bangkok Post newspaper, June last year. I simply scanned it, but it shows very clearly a substantial Arab dhow. This is the first one to be discovered on a land site where it can be properly investigated and documented. The shipwreck we'll be discussing, the cargo was in the water, in the ocean, and the timbers are really quite a poor state. What was on board this vessel, various ropes and fibres to do with the rigging of the vessel, and lots of fragmentary ceramics, earthenware ceramics of various sorts. We don't have any reports yet. Again, this is from the newspaper feature. These very distinctive amphora. We've not seen them before. Very, very distinct. They're Most amphora tend to be narrow mouthed, bulbous with a pointy bottom. Here it's a wide mouth version. And I'll just show you the great 6th century mural from Ajanta. Many of you, of course, you all know this. And you'll see in the foredeck of the boat all these wide mouthed amphora stacked on the decking. And I'd suggest to you that's very probably the type of amphora we're looking at here. This is the first example we know of from a wreck in Southeast Asia. If anyone's seen this form of amphora in a South Asian context, please tell me after the lecture. I'd be most interested. But this is very, very important discovery, which is the Thai Archaeology Department is now actively working on and will be reporting on more fully soon. Other things show up, a piece of lustreware from Iran, 10th, 11th century. That showed up as a result of the tsunami that hit North Sumatra. How long was that, 6 years ago? And a whole lot of things are washed up out of the harbour at Aceh, ended up a considerable distance inland. And this fragment, a colleague sent me a picture recently. It's a recent find from the harbour at Aceh. Again, we know that the North Sumatra had strong links to the Islamic world. It was the first place in Southeast Asia to accept Islam and had a very active trading history. Amphora discovered 50 or 60 years ago in Sarawak in Borneo. I've actually consulted every Islamic ceramic specialist I know in the world about this, and no one has cracked it. No one can actually tell me where or when it was made. It's certainly old. It may well relate to this family of ceramics from Iran, and a complete example recovered in Western Borneo in the 1950s. Arab traders were active in all sorts of ways. Many of you who know a little of Vijayanagar history will know that Vijayanagar had a very extensive cavalry and depended on importing its horses from the Arabian world, and that Arab traders controlled that trade. We know that because the Portuguese tried to force their way in on the trade, get a slice of the action, but essentially it was in the hands of Arab traders. And here we have a mural from Tanjavur district, South India, showing that they're also active on the southeast coast of India. We know of them using the ports of the west coast to serve Vijayanagar. Here we have a mural in Tamil Nadu indicating they're also active down there as well. Very, very interesting, 17th century. Now, in the whole story of exchange and trade, one very important factor is the role of, and in terms of our understanding of the history, is the role of Chinese Buddhist pilgrims. We know there were many thousands who went, many of whom stayed and never returned to China, many of whom didn't survive the journey. Some kept diaries and most didn't. We have roughly half a dozen important diaries from the early 5th to the beginning of the 8th century, which provide really the single best insight we have, really the only primary first-hand observation we have of the nature of travelling in South Asia and Southeast Asia in this period, because they describe their journeys, they describe the hazards, the dangers, and so on. You know, Fasien in the 5th century writes very bitterly through gritted teeth when they were caught in a storm between Sri Lanka and Sumatra. The merchants were throwing their cargo, being obliged to throw their cargo overboard by the captain, and he was pressured by the captain to throw his sutras overboard, which he refused to do, and prayed to the Bodhisattva instead, and the storms were calmed, so all was well. But the nature of the trade is very vividly described in these commentaries, as, of course, is the everyday life in a Buddhist vihara. The monastic life is well documented as well. The only first-hand observations we have of that. With the rise to prominence of Bodhisattva cults, particularly in the 7th century onwards, in Buddhist South Asia, you, very early on you see that the Bodhisattva comes to prominence as a protector against the Astamahapada, the eight great perils of life. And the, one, included in, these, in this very select group of eight great dangers is danger to mariners. Clearly seen as important, lower right, mariners in distress, and you know, praying to the Bodhisattva to save them from a storm or whatever. And the this is Kankeri near Mumbai, 7th century. Sopara was the great port, of course, not far from here. So these caves were almost certainly the product of merchant activity under the patronage of merchant communities involved in the coastal port trade on the Arabian Sea and beyond. So protective deities for Buddhism becomes important. Dipankara, the bearer of the light, the Buddha as the bearer of light, directly associated with protecting mariners. A very rare subject to be represented. This is a Pala manuscript, 12th century. And you see Rahu and all the troublesome elements. And two ships, presumably in distress. They're rather quaint little pleasure boats, really, rather than serious ocean-going boats. But you still get the general picture. Buddhist pilgrims travel, but the Buddhist merchants we know were very, very active, and they've left us some of the earliest records. Kedah in the Malay Peninsula, directly opposite the island of Penang in the Straits of Malacca, in the midst of the rubber plantations, are a whole series of temple remains spanning from 7th, 8th century through to the 12th, 13th century, and extensive archaeological remains of trade goods. This was an important entrepot, place where goods were exchanged, warehoused, and people restocked for secondary trading. So a very important site. Kedah is almost certainly the Arabic Kala, again, which is talked about already in the 7th and 8th centuries in the Arabic navigational texts. From this region, it's essentially one river valley, the Bujang Valley in Kedah, a network of two or three rivers then feed out of this valley, and there are temple sites quite a long way up the river, penetrating into the hinterland. Two stone steles were recovered. This is one of them. This is the most famous one. It was found in the 1834 and shipped off to Calcutta. It's found by an East India Company person and sent to Calcutta. It's still in the museum today. And a very famous piece. It's essentially thanksgiving for safe passage, recording that they made their journey successfully, thanking the Buddha and so on, and names the person who commissioned it, and he identifies himself as the great sea captain, Buddha Gupta. So that's very clear. It's a mercantile sailor who commissioned this and depicted a particular style of stupa, this pedestal base, lotus, cylindrical drum, and multiple umbrellas. It's a type we recognize as particularly from South India. Paleographically, probably early 6th century, has been dated earlier, but the current opinion is around early 6th. Very important record. The second one was found about 20 years ago with Buddha's credo on it, but not naming the patron. The site of Lampo near Chaya, if any of you know the resort island of Koh Samui in Thailand, it's very famous and very expensive. You can see that on a clear day from this beach on the Bay of Gulf of Thailand. This beach is a very faded photograph that I took longer ago than I care to admit. If you walk on the beach at low tide, just when I took this picture, you're literally walking on 8th and 9th century ceramic shards, large quantities of Tang Dynasty Chinese ceramics. I didn't know that when I went there, but I got a sense of what I was walking on. I pursued the subject at that point. The local museum helped a lot. They had already this small display in the local museum at Chaya, and it's a very interesting little diagnostic group of objects, all recovered in this immediate area. There are several very important temples in the area, Buddhist sanctuaries, and there's a very important Srivijayan inscription which mentions the creation of three chapels under the commissioned by a minister of the Srivijayan king, and mentions the particular bodhisattvas that occupied these sanctuaries, and the great, very beautiful bronze upper torso of a bejeweled bodhisattva in the National Museum, Bangkok, which is a national treasure. Many of you can bring it to mind, I'm sure, almost certainly came from this chapel. The beaches, which were clearly a transshipment point, because this is the narrow bit of the isthmus of the peninsula, they were almost certainly not doing the down around Singapore route, but transshipping across the narrow point. Hence, a lot of wasted goods, damaged goods, were cast off at that point. So-called Dusan storage jars. We know exactly where these were made upriver in Canton. The kilns have been identified in the last 10 or 15 years. Early UA, this is proto-Celadon. Green splashed wares, almost never seen at this point. This fragment puzzled everybody. We didn't know what these were. They're not recorded in China. Early white wares of types that were most unfamiliar to normal people in the ceramic world. A little saucer dish with an indented circular foot, very distinctive. And more green splashed wares and so on. This photo I took 30 years ago, and I never imagined that we would then eventually see a cargo which had thousands of these pieces. These are some of the other fragments from the same site. These are the very famous Changsha wares, stone wares painted in irons and copper, browns and greens, in very abstracted mass production wares. Oops, what's happening here? Okay, which brings us to the Beletung, the first great shipwreck, so-called Tang shipwreck, discovered in 98 and excavated 98-99. A large number, something like 65,000 objects were recorded, brought up from the seabed. That wasn't everything. It's in relatively shallow waters, and the site was also... fishermen paid a visit, and fishermen, a lot of things turned up on the antique market in Bangkok, in Jakarta as well. So not everything has been recorded, but the Navy stepped in and protected the site, and the bulk of it has been protected. The seabed contained vast number of these ceramics. As I said, of the 65,000, something like 55,000 were Changsha wares. Just stacked, these would have been bound in rattan or whatever, and straw, that's all disappeared, and that's how they were transported from the kilns, coastal shipping to the, or canals or river systems in China to the coast, and then sold on to the foreign merchants. Lots of enormous quantity of these mundane things. There were also a lot of lead ingots, as well as more as precious metal. What was staggering, during the recovery of this wreck, they found a small compartment at the stern, probably near the ship's captain's cabin or something like that, with about 20 precious metal objects. Gold, solid gold objects, gilt silver objects, and silver objects. Staggering quality. This octagonal wine cup, West Asian, Central Asian design. We only knew of... There are only two others of these known in existence, and they both come from, one came from a very famous temple relic chamber. It was a royal deposit by the king, or the emperor, I should say, in Chang'an, in the Tang capital, the Farmen Pagoda relic chamber. And the other was from a royal tomb, again, 8th, early 9th century. This is the largest and the heaviest of the three. It's clearly imperial quality. The little raised figures are cast separately and riveted onto the surface. They're all West Asian, dressed in the West Asian manner. And the whole convention, whole design, in fact, is of West Asian inspiration. There was clearly something going on in this ship that was of much more importance than just shipping crockery around the world. There was clearly a cargo which included top-end objects. These are of a quality that's absolutely consistent with the imperial deposits we know about from China. Same quality. So they were either going as a diplomatic gift from one court to another, or they were just very high-end luxury goods to be sold in the Abbasid, to wealthy Abbasid merchants in the Persian Gulf, who can say. Buddhist motifs and so on, little moths and, of course, swastika. Just the quality is breathtaking, yeah? Little faceted indented saucer dishes, pair of swans, cranes, whatever, gilt silver quatrefoil box with perky lion, beautiful quality, engraved and chased. A very large pilgrim flask, you can see from the scale here. I mean, this is a big object, silver, very brittle now. Presented a lot of conservation issues when they were considering touring an exhibition of some of this material. This was not an option. It was too fragile to travel, but a spectacular item. These are really top-end objects. The Chinese commentators, the people who controlled the harbours in the 12th and 13th centuries, left quite detailed descriptions of how trade was conducted. And one of the things they mentioned just in passing is the cargoes were stacked very, very systematically, packed very densely. They served as ballast in the vessels, and they would stack the small objects in the large one until not a crevice remained. And we've never seen evidence of that. The other cargoes that have been seen have all been loose shipped, you know, probably just in rattan and surf fiber protection. But here we find on this vessel, significant number of the Changsha wares were stacked in these big Alibaba jars. The bowls themselves are made in Henan, in south central China, quite a long way inland, very important kiln production. It was really the beginnings of mass production for export in China. This is where the story really begins, in the late 700s and 800s. And these were mass produced. The bowl was made, a slip was applied, it was dipped on the four corners, and the next person on the production chain quickly painted the design or whatever. They were made in South Central China, but they were packed in jars that we know were made in Canton. So they were taken down there, then repacked in Canton for the shipment, long distance shipment. They also, in those jars, shipped spices. This is Staranese, Chinese spice, traces of which have been identified. The jars themselves are quite spectacular. Some have little Chinese, probably who commissioned the work, the particular merchant. I don't think they're a maker's mark. They're probably a buyer's mark. And there are others which have sort of pseudo-Arabic inscription. So quite clearly they were intended for the Arab merchants who had commissioned these items and would come back next season to collect them. One of the jars from the Li Tung cargo, and I show you two fragments here, one on here with the pseudo-Arabic. These two fragments were recovered from below the flooring stones of the Friday Mosque in Siraf in Iran. Now that mosque was built in 820 AD. These were found beneath the paving stones of the floor. It gives you a beautiful terminal date for these were in Iraq already before 820 AD. Very, very exciting. That sort of jar has been circulating from South China well before this period. Two more examples from the shipwreck. And then the Changsha way, as I've mentioned several times, very distinctive. Again, some have patterns which people say, oh, maybe it's meant to be Arabic. You know, it's a little bit, has that sort of cursive quality. And others may just be calligraphic. Whole range of subject matter. The evidence we have for dating the cargo largely hangs, apart from the sort of generic, it fits into a 9th century setting, but this bowl is inscribed into the wet clay with a date equivalent to 823. So we're firmly in the second quarter of the 9th century. These were commercial products. They wouldn't sit around. You'd ship them out as soon as you reasonably could. So there's every likelihood that the vessel sailed within 2 or 3 years of when this bowl was made. It puts us, you know, 825 or something like that. And very nice way to date the vessel. Also had a very, very rare and important, for those in the world of Chinese bronze mirrors, which I'm certainly not, an enormously important bronze mirror dated to the mid-8th century, an heirloom piece recovered on the cargo. Just to give you a sense of where these bowls travelled, they're well known. I've seen fragments of these in the Thai Peninsula, as I mentioned, for a long, long time. They're found in central Java. These fragments on the left are pieces from excavations of the great Abhayagiri stupa at Anuradhapura in Sri Lanka. And in the excavations that were conducted in the 1970s and 80s, they accumulated mountains of shard material, which I was given privileged access to, the tin shed where all the shards were stacked. And for every 100 local ceramics, there was one foreign piece. And these are the photographs I took sometime in the late 80s of pieces I pulled out from the stacks and photographed and put back. Changsha ware, no question, coming exactly by the same trade route that the great shipwreck. So these would have come in through the ports up near Jaffna, supplying the royal capital of Anuradhapura in Sri Lanka. These wonderful West Asian style wine jugs, I guess you'd call them, with their molded grapevine decorations, very, very Samarkand, very West Asian, spectacular pieces. We have a whole phenomenon of Islamic pottery about which we don't know a great deal in the second half of the first millennium. The story is being pieced together. It's a very early piece, somewhere from the Persian Gulf, probably Iraq, date 6th, 7th, 8th century. It's difficult to tie it down. On the left, a piece which I saw by chance in Manila a few years back, excavated in the Philippines. Again, this is part of this whole dissemination through the Islamic trade. Spectacular and complete piece. These sorts of jars, the turquoise, particularly turquoise glazed jars, of which significant quantities are being found increasingly in the excavations in Kerala in the last 2 or 3 years, very important excavations that many of you will be familiar with on the Malabar coast. Not maritime sites, but immediate coastal shoreline sites producing a lot of shards of this sort of material. This particular jar was recovered from the tomb of a minor queen in Fujian, a little local dynasty, dated to the beginning of the 11th century, and four of these jars are in her tomb. Clearly high-value exotic objects being consumed in China. We have a record from the King Indravarman, one of the Cham kings in central Vietnam, the king, in fact, who built the Dong Duong Monastery, a great Mahayanist monastery dedicated in 856, very famous, just near Da Nang. We don't have any archaeological evidence, but the inscription, there's a source which tells us he sent tribute to China and he sent 20 Arab jars to China. That was his gift to China, to the emperor. And this almost certainly is what he would have sent. It's what would have been available to him through the coastal trade happening along the Vietnamese coast, which made the Chums very wealthy. The British Museum piece, Uncertain Provenance, Persian Gulf, fragments from various sites. This is Carolan Coast, that's Malay Peninsula, that I think is South Vietnam. They're really diagnostic. They really help us plot the whole trade route that these wares travelled. More examples. So I should have edited these down a little bit more, sorry. Okay. Now, there's a whole series of spectacular pieces here from the Bat Tong shipwreck. Very simple indented bowls, very plain, very beautiful. We now know these were made in one particular kiln site. And at the same wares became clear when you started examining these that the white wares and the various splashed wares are the same wares. It's the same ceramic. One has an applied decoration and one doesn't. That's the only difference. The so-called Guangxiang wares. Kiln has since been identified just in the last 5 years. So we know we have a precise kiln provenance for these items. These were being traded all the way to West Asia. This is an Islamic copy, if you like, of that Chinese import. Sorry, Mike. From the shipwreck here in the Met, we have this fragment recovered in Iran and part of the excavations from Samarra. But no complete example from the shipwreck. Got complete examples, and now we have a dated context for these, beginning of the 9th century. Oh, sorry. Samarra is very important in Iran as a major centre in the 9th century. It had a relatively short life, and here are examples of Chinese green splashed wares. This is all we really knew about green splashed wares, the Samarra excavations conducted by the Germans. There are many in Berlin. These fragments are in the V&A. This fragment is the British Museum. But they provided a very important window on the Chinese trade to the Persian Gulf. Iranian splashed wares imitating the Chinese imports. On the shipwreck, for the first time, 300 examples of green splashed wares were recovered. They've never been found before. They're almost unrecorded in China. We only knew the fragments from West Asia before. Now we have a whole cargo containing over 300 examples. Again, transforms our understanding of the importance of this ware in the 9th century. They didn't last that long. These went out of fashion relatively quickly. They may well have only had a production life of 50 years or something like that. They weren't around very long, but they had an impact. So here's the Chinese ware, and here already is the Islamic imitation. When they were developing the technologies, both in Basra and in sites, in Iranian sites along the Persian Gulf, copying, producing wares inspired by the Chinese ones. The bases of both, see, very different. This is the Chinese, very fine-bodied, low recessed foot. Here's the rather cruder Iranian version. Again, white wares and then green splashed here, clearly imitating metalwork with the makara spout and the leopard handle, very distinctive metalwork type. Stem cups of various sorts. I'm going to skip through these because it's rather a lot of material. This object is unique in ceramic history. It's nearly 1 meter in height, which is quite staggering. It survived almost intact. The only restoration is to the strap handle. The little dragon head stopper is detachable. It's the most complete, spectacular vessel that's been recovered from the late Tang period. It was found on the shipwreck. It's quite obvious when you look at it, look at the way the handle's constructed, the little strap that holds the handle in place. It's purely copying metalwork. It's metalwork inspired. There's the detail, engraved decoration, very, very beautiful, a real tour de force of ceramic art. And where did it come from? It's come from West Asian metalwork, which we know was being imported in the Abbasid and Sasanian periods into China, to Chang'an, the Tang capital, and elsewhere, where they were copied. And we know that local copies were being made of these imported wares. This piece is from Nara in Japan, from the Shusho Inn, the great repositories of ancient trade, Silk Route trade objects, now preserved now in Nara. Almost certainly, the Japanese say it's Japanese, but I think it's almost certainly a Chinese import to Japan. It's a local Chinese copy of what was probably a silver West Asian import, now lost, and that in turn has been copied in ceramic and shipped back to West Asia. So there's your chain of cultural exchange going on within a relatively short period of time. So ideas circulating, objects circulating, being copied, replicated in different materials, a whole chain of cultural dialogue going on in one object. The other thing that's interesting about this object is this pattern. You have this sort of diamond pattern, lozenge, with four little floral bursts on the corner. It repeats itself on the green splashed wares in the cargo. It's on that dish. It's here. I think, do I have a detail? Yes. Very distinctive. It's not Chinese. You never see it in China. It doesn't exist in the Chinese repertoire. You go back to early Iranian metalwork. Oh, yes, it's there. It's a West Asian motif. Very distinctive. It's really a sort of triangle with palmettes, radiating palmettes coming out of the corners. This is an early Abbasid motif, which clearly must again travel by metal to China, or could have been suggested by the merchants who commissioned these works for the West Asian market. And these designs are clearly, I'm going to sell this in the Persian Gulf. Give me a lozenge with floral projections, with all palmettes, and that's what they've done. Here it is in another fragment of a dish. That's the German excavation at Samarra, recovered in the 1930s, same design, which we didn't have any complete examples until this shipwreck. There it is in the splashed ware, and there it is again in the two examples of blue and underglaze, blue and white, that were recovered on the shipwreck. Blue and white doesn't really exist until the late Song, beginnings of the Yuan period. It's really a 12th century phenomenon, stimulated again actually by West Asian trade, but it's a different story. But there are a handful, and you can literally count them on one hand, examples of blue and white from the late Tang dynasty, all fragmentary. This shipwreck produced two complete examples. The people in the ceramics world, this was very exciting. And it's technically not, it's flawed, it's not true blue and white. It's a low-fired stoneware, it's not a porcelain. It's really in glaze painting. Rather than underglaze, and when it's fired, the cobalt bleeds. You can see it's not controlled. So I think they just gave up. The technology, it wasn't working. They tried cobalt blue, they tried copper red, both the colours just bled. So we have examples, but just a handful. And it wasn't attempted again for three centuries until they developed the use of kaolin, high-fired, technology ceramics, the famous blue and whites, which started to appear, of which you have great examples from the 13th and 14th centuries here in Delhi and elsewhere, recovered from Sultanate period palaces and complexes and so on. So very, very important. That's another chapter in the story. There's your Samarra green splashed ware. Here's your local imitation. That's that motif again, but that's Iranian. A very rare piece in the V&A, and two other versions. There it is, spectacular. And you'll notice it's indented. It's just that white saucer we saw before with the cobalt added. That's the Guangxian ware. And an enormously rare fragment recovered from Yangzhou, the great Tang dynasty port of South China, and there it is again. This was only found about 4 years ago, And it's in private hands in Yangzhou, and didn't find its way into a museum, but it has photographs have been released. And there you have the juxtaposition, the local piece from Yangzhou, probably intended for export, but didn't make it, the dish that did, and then here's your West Asian imitation. The next great wreck is the Intan, we have two wrecks, the Intan and the Cherubon, both fall roughly in the mid-10th century. The dating's pretty reliable. There's significant numbers of Chinese coins, which we have time limits, which place it in the sort of 930s, 940s to about the 960s, in that sort of territory, mid-quarter of the 10th century. Both of these ships are for local regional trade, not long distance. They're probably just touring, going around the islands, trading. Lashed construction, this is your indigenous prow, the Malay prow type vessel. It's not your Arab dhow, it's not a clinker construction, it's a pegged and lashed construction. This is a whole clutch of these boats were found in Mindanao, southern Philippines, in the last 15 years, Butuan. And the cargo is lots of earthenware pottery that we've not really seen before, certainly not in complete examples. Occasionally fragments show up in excavations, but complete pieces, no. Whereas in the cargo, pristine examples, a whole range of kendi, no doubt for ritual use, coming out of the Intan shipwreck. These will be produced probably in Sumatra. They've been traded to Java and other places, probably to Bali as well. A whole range of Chinese wares, again, very rare in terms of Chinese production because they weren't used much in China, though these were made for export. But still a quality object like a pillow, a Chinese ceramic pillow you see here, open work, little fish, what are called fish jars with these little patterns and so on, and a whole series of these types of vessels. The little jars upper left, little melon-shaped covered boxes in Jingbai, it's a sort of bluish-tinted glaze. Significant numbers of these have been excavated at Angkor in Cambodia in the last 10 years. They were circuit. We know the Chinese merchants were operating at Angkor, and now we've got this. Once people start to look for it, once they start to recognize it, we have quite a body of evidence that supports the historical accounts we have from the 12th and 13th century. What's a little covered sort of lotus bud bowls with a sweet little cover, all from the Intan wreck. And here are wasters from a kiln site at Angkor, at Phnom Kualen, which we know is active in the 10th and 12th century. And for my money, these have to be direct imitations of these imports. We haven't found these at Angkor, but here are the local versions. They haven't come out of nowhere. They're clearly inspired by Chinese imports that aren't available to us anymore. Ingots of silver, official. They have cast inscriptions which give their weight and prohibitions about messing with taking a corner off, whatever, keep their weight accurate and so on. This is official trade in bullion, regulated trade in bullion. Significant number of these. Hundreds and hundreds of lead ingots, probably for local barter, and quite a lot of tin ingots as well. Very important series of bronze molds for making Buddhist clay impressions, what the Tibetans called tsatsa, and replication of little making little clay impressions as acts of devotion, very familiar in the Buddhist context. And there's a molding, multi-arm to Avalokiteshvara from the Malay Peninsula, a bodhisattva and a stupa molding with script, five lines of script in the background, recovered from this vessel. What were they doing on that ship? I don't think they're made in India. I think they're probably made at one of the great Mahaviharas in Sumatra, associated with Srivijaya, and then being shipped to other sites, probably South Coast Borneo, Java, where we know there were Buddhist communities in this period. Many of you have seen these little clay miniature stupas, so-called stupika is the casual name that they're given. Very common. They show up at sites from Gandhara to the Deccan. They're very widely spread. Never found a mold for one before. Here's a bronze mold that gives you a Borobudur-type stupa, actually, with these little projections. We're only 100 years after Borobudur, and this bronze mold came from that shipwreck. Conch shells, ready for use, already carved and decorated for your ritual libations. Little bronze stands to support them. Tamil inscription on a fragment of probably a talam. It's an offering tray in an Indonesian context. And then ritual utensils, vajras, gantas, the thunderbolt scepters, the bells, and so on, a whole range of these. Here we have some bells, symbols, used, of course, in ritual a lot, and very elaborate door knocker. This is door furniture with ring handles and so on, with a sort of Kerti Muka, the Indonesians call Kala, Kala face design here, again coming off this shipwreck cargo. Gold objects, but local. This is Indonesian, Western Indonesian work. What are called modesty plaques and probably a handle for a fly whisk, fan of some sort, a whole rings, jewellery, set stones, fragments of a largely lost tradition of gold working. And then in the same cargo, Islamic glass. It really is an international cargo. On the right is a fragment from the cargo, on the left a complete piece to give you a sense. The glass, we don't know where it's coming from. Syria, Fostat, Egypt, those were sort of regions. This vessel on the left came from the same shipwreck. There's a complete example on the right just for comparison. So this shipwreck and the one that I'll conclude with, the Cherubon, same time frame, had this incredibly international mix of objects. It gave you a real sense of the trading world that was operating within Southeast Asia. The Cherubon had very beautiful northern Song ceramics of a type you don't see much of in China. The quality is superb. Principally Yue ware, that's sort of proto-celadon, sort of the beginnings of green glazed stoneware. Again, these little jarlets, big storage jars, bronze mirrors. A spectacularly interesting object. It's glazed ceramic. It's intended to function, obviously, as an oil lamp. And what is it? It's the motif of the Indian Makara, which we know was transmitted to China with Buddhism in the early centuries AD, absorbed into Chinese imagery and imagination, and recycled as a ceramic oil lamp and shipped back this direction. I mean, very, very interesting. This is, the Makara has gone full circle, if you like, through Chinese technology. And several of the bowls in the cargo, the Changsha wares, going back to the Balatung shipwreck, Makara. It's not just a fish. He's got a sort of elephant trunk sort of nose. And here we have a Makara eating a ship. I mean, you know, you get that on Bahut, actually, in the roundels. The vessel disappearing down the jaws of a great Makara. There is exactly what's happening on. That's a unique piece. Of the 55,000 pieces in the cargo, this is the only one that shows a sea monster about to gobble up a little Chinese sailing vessel. Very, very revealing. What else was in these cargoes? High quality, high value raw materials being shipped, not processed. So on the Cherubon, large chunks of lapis lazuli. I mean, big. I saw them. I mean, they'd fill a small bucket. Chunks had been taken out, had been processed, so they'd sawn off some bits to sell. But lapis lazuli, you know, of course, only comes from Afghanistan historically. Extremely high value, used a lot as inlay in bronzes and other high-value courtly and particularly temple objects. Very, very important. Here's the raw material being shipped. We've never had that before. Large chunks of rock crystal. I mean, these are big pieces of rock crystal, again, shipped as raw material. Large quantities of recycled bronze, broken up, what literally must have been scrap metal, and had been hammered up, hammered down into, compacted, like a sort of, car recycling yard, and that was being shipped, no doubt, to Java, which is short of both gold and copper, where it would be melted down and reused to make new things. Gold objects. But this provenance, not clear. Looks a little bit Chinese. I would suggest it's probably Sumatran, Western Indonesian production, copying Chinese things. A whole series of bits of jewellery, about which we know very, very little. And the only reference point, really, because so little South Asian jewellery of antiquity survives, I mean, minuscule amount. One of the most famous pieces many of you all know is the great pendant stone ear ornament from Sigiriya in Sri Lanka, one of the rarest discoveries of South Asian jewellery. Here we have like 10 pieces from this single cargo, set with pearls, inset stones, and so on. Sorry, the photographs aren't great. They were taken in the godown. Quantities of precious and semi-precious stones being shipped. They recovered a few from the seabed. There were probably thousands more that weren't recovered, probably coming from Sri Lanka. Moulds for casting jewellery, small stone moulds for casting jewellery, crucibles for processing working gold. Gold objects. This is actually a Buddhist sutra page from a gold manuscript. It's engraved with some Buddhist script, rather inaccurate, really written, but nonetheless, you can faintly see the text inscribed into it there. And then a series of Mahayana Vajrayana bronzes, all pieces we normally associate with Java and assumed were made in Java. This vessel, the evidence is cumulatively very clear, this vessel was going to Java. So the whole assumption that many of these objects, particularly the ritual utensils and religious imagery, were made in Java is turned on its head. The ship was on its way. So it's very likely that they were being made somewhere else. I would suggest probably Sumatra, which we had had strong production centres associated with its monasteries, and done in the style which we always, on any museum label, we'd call it, Eastern Javanese, Central Javanese, whatever. Monks' stuff. Oil lamps. Fragments of large oil lamps that stand 3 feet high, spectacular pieces. My colleagues and I looked at examples of exactly this sort of bronze object excavated at Anuradhapura. Not so long ago, these are fragments coming out of the Java Sea wreck, from the Cherubon wreck. A talam, this is the offering dish, beautiful engraved designs, lamps and so on. Vajra. Ivory dice, board games of some sort. Extraordinary little stone mould. These are the channels to pour the metal, and here is the actual amulet that's being made. And what is it? It's a little Islamic talisman, probably cast in tin or maybe in silver, and the channel would go into these little conduits to cast these simple little protective amulets. Fascinating objects we've not seen before, and part of the early spread of Islam in Indonesia, because we remember we were mid-10th century. So in terms of Islam in Southeast Asia, this is very early. It hadn't really impacted in any significant way at that point, but this was presumably for use by the expatriate merchant community. Islamic rock crystal. These are very rare, very important. largely only known from West Asian sources. This is a fish sort of amulet. Came out of the Cherevon shipwreck. Little glass tripod stands. Here is a very old German publication showing a number of these little crystal objects from this West Asia, including the little fish. Here is one of the most complete examples ever recorded out of our shipwreck just 10 years ago. And spectacular handle for a dagger. Has to be Western Indonesian workmanship. Very beautiful. It's relatively thin gold over a resin core. The traces of the iron blade are still visible. And there's another view, spectacularly beautiful and rare things. Again, about which we knew very, very little. Almost nothing survives of this type of material. We have two examples, in fact, from this one shipwreck open a window on the luxury production of these items. It also carries an inscription around the top of the hilt, which is in old Javanese and is still just beginning to be deciphered. There we are. So, I think that will bring us to a conclusion, I think, just to sum up that we have three spectacular cargoes from the 9th and 10th century. The Balatung, which essentially gives archaeological proof to something we sort of knew already from the historical sources, particularly the Arabic sources, which talked about this long-distance trade, which everyone was slightly skeptical about. But when the Blitung ship was found with its massive cargo of South Chinese wares, and the vessel itself was identified as an Arab dhow, there was no question that this was a long-distance trader destined for West Asian markets. And then we have the Intan and the Cherevon, really only 120-odd years later, coming onto the picture, trading within the Southeast Asian region with a complex of cargoes that links China to the Malay world for local earthenware and other items, to South Asian world through the Buddhist imagery, and then West Asia through ceramics and particularly the spectacular glass and rock crystal. So you can see the complex mix of international cargo that was going on. And of course, with all these objects, it wasn't just the commercial exchange, it's the sort of cultural spin-off and fallout from the presence of these exotic objects that stimulates other complexities in the region and the art they produce in the future. Thank you. We've run on a little, so I apologise for that. If anyone has questions, perhaps we can deal with them individually. Thank you.
Everybody.